Hello and welcome to Bite Back Chats Books. This week we're travelling to the fjords of Norway with Tony Insall, whose book, Secret Alliances, is all about the fascinating relationship between British and Norwegian secret services during the Second World War. It's a tale of daring, subterfuge and the amazing things you can find out whilst digging around in secret archives. And Tony is the best placed person to tell it. So without further ado, welcome. Tony Insall, welcome to the Bite Back Virtual Podcast.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. And we're here to talk about your book, Secret Alliances, which is now out in paperback, featuring a foreword from Sir John Scarlett, who was head of MI6, is that right?
Correct, yes. Secret Intelligence Service.
Secret Intelligence, which is very much the heart of this of your book. And so I think without further ado, let's just jump in. So Secret Alliances is, I'm sure you can explain it more succinctly than I, but an overview of the collaboration between the British and Norwegian resistances during the Second World War. My first question to you is probably going to be, what inspired you to write Secret Alliances? Because it is quite a niche, I would say, a niche subject to explore.
Well, I suppose it's a niche that I've been spending some time in already, because I've written several other books about both about Britain and Norway and also about Scandinavia from a historical point of view. Perhaps the most interesting and relevant here was that I'd written a book about the relationship, the secret aspects of the relationship between the British and Norwegian Labour parties just after the war, when they were collaborating to disseminate anti-communist propaganda that was being produced by the Information Research Department of the Foreign Office, set up by Ernest Bevin, who was very worried about the spread of communist influence. And in a way, you could almost call that Secret Alliances too, because that was a secret alliance of a different kind, but I hadn't thought of that at the time. So Secret Alliances got quite rightly, I think, used to describe the relations between the British and Norwegians to work against the Germans in Norway. And why I was interested in that aspect, there's a lot of material that I discovered in both British and Norwegian archives. About 40% of the book is actually a new unpublished material. Both the Special Operations Executive, the SOE archive in Britain, and also naval intelligence files in Britain, but most particularly the Secret Intelligence Service, the SIS archive, of which describes the Norwegian side of the relationship, which they took back to Norway at the end of the war, and that's available for researchers. Now, not everyone knows that the SIS archive in Britain is closed and will probably remain closed forever. So for a researcher to have access to any SIS material in a collected form like that's pretty exciting, and I wanted to make the best use of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's quite incredible to think there was so much that remains secret about the collaboration between the UK and Norway. And I know that is mentioned in the book, that this relationship that they had during the Second World War is quite well documented in Norway, but less so in the UK. Do you think that's because of the secret archives, or is there another reason for that?
I think it's more to do with the fact that Norway was occupied, and that has a big impact on any country. What's more, Norway had only been independent since 1905, when it gained its independence from Sweden. So it had been independent for all of 35 years when the Germans invaded. And that made their loss of freedom really hard to bear for the new country. We were in a much more fortunate position because we haven't been occupied for over a thousand years, or nearly a thousand years. So it mattered more to the Norwegians, and I think therefore was more of a subject for their historians, whereas we were not only interested in writing about Norway, but also about relations with France and all sorts of other aspects of the war, all equally important, but not enough space perhaps for to give more coverage for Norway, which was good for me because it meant that nobody else had written about the subject that I wanted to cover.
Yeah, we had our fingers in many pies, foreign affairs speaking. So if you take us right back then to the start of the Second World War, obviously, like, Norway's been occupied. Initially, I was quite surprised to learn that the British and Norwegian resistances, although ultimately they would have had the same goal, didn't actually work together for quite a while. So can you just talk a little bit about maybe the start of the resistances, like how they developed and how they came to work together?
Sure. Yeah, well, to begin with, the Norwegians didn't really have very much experience at all of fighting, let alone resistance, because they'd been largely neutral, effectively neutral during the First World War. They hadn't got an established intelligence service. Their military wasn't really very well equipped either for this kind of war, although the Norwegian army gave a good account of itself in large parts of the campaign when the Germans were invading Norway. So they had a lot to learn. We, the Brits, really didn't want to share too much of our planning and the things that we wanted to do in resistance movements with the Norwegians or the governments of other countries. So we just wanted Norwegians to work for us without really disclosing very much, if anything, to Norwegian ministers or military commanders. And to begin with, they accepted that more or less because they wanted to get resistance going. But it did mean that when operations started to be carried out on the Norwegian mainland, which Norwegian ministers, the government didn't know about in advance, they understandably got a bit cross. And that led, particularly after some attacks by combined operations at the end of 1941, that led to some arguments and the threat of a withdrawal of some cooperation, which led to the setting up of a coordination committee, which greatly improved things. So we had to have, if you like, a good, open, pragmatic discussion before we got to the point where we could improve things. I should add also that to begin with, thought that Norwegians were not terribly experienced in the ways of the world, so not very security conscious, that they drank a bit too much. So we didn't really want to trust them very much on that score either. Now, those are accusations that can't only be levelled at Norwegians, but plenty of other people that I can think of. So I think we were being a bit hypocritical, but it needed to have that sort of clearing of the air. And once we'd done that, things became much more open and straightforward and much more trusting. And that trust just grew the further the war progressed. And the more we saw that Norwegians were capable of doing really of effective things back in Norway, the more we trusted them.
How then did this new combined resistance work? You mentioned a coordination committee. Were decisions taken through that and then filtered out to the agents?
It was more to do with the coordination of the way the operations were actually run. And this, I should say, was for SOE, for the Special Operations Executive. We'll perhaps come on to discuss SIS in a moment, because what they did was of a rather different nature. But the Norwegians needed to know, wanted to know in advance of what was going to be done in Norway. And quite often they were able to make useful suggestions about how some of the planning could be improved. So it wasn't so much that this was filtered back to the agents. The agents were at the end of the chain, if you like. It was more to give the government and the military commanders confidence in the way that activities were being planned in Norway, which, after all, the government of Norway was still effectively the government, although the National Socialists and the Germans would have disagreed, but they had authority from the parliament, Norwegian parliament, before they left the country. They had continuing authority as long as the war lasted. So they were, in the eyes of all free Norwegians and many within Norway too, the legally constituted government of the country. So they needed to know what was going on.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating subject in itself, to be honest, the Norwegian government trying to establish itself in exile in London. But just to quickly touch back on the SOE and the SIS, can you just explain a little bit then the scope of their activities in Norway?
The main purpose of SOE was sabotage, subversion, certain types of propaganda, all things that were really intended in one way or another to degrade the German war effort. Now, they could do that by denying blowing up factories, disrupting the supply of precious minerals, because Norway had quite a few of those, sometimes transport, communications, things like that. So that was the sort of area that they were involved in. And of course, all of those things tended to make big bangs or cause damage and cause German reactions. The work that was carried out by SIS, the intelligence collection of intelligence, was really quite different, because for that, SIS, Norwegian agents, needed peace and quiet, and they didn't want anyone taking an interest in their activities. They wanted to keep right away from all of that. And what they were doing was gathering intelligence, coastal intelligence, on the activities of the German Navy, the German Merchant Marine, and other Norwegian ships too, which were carrying supplies back from Norway to Germany. The key element of that was keeping an eye on the movement of German naval ships, because they were a threat to both Atlantic convoys and also to convoys going from Britain and America via Iceland to the Soviet Union, the Atlantic convoys via up to Murmansk.
And I know the SOE, I think, generally tends to get most airtime when it comes to talking about World War II, because, like you say, they did the big and flashy stuff, most notably blowing up a heavy water plant in Norway that the Germans were trying to use to manufacture some kind of proto-nuclear device. But I just wanted to ask a bit more about the SIS, to be honest, because the intelligence gathering was absolutely crucial in terms of, you know, turning the tide of the war. So how important was the SIS's work in Norway?
Well, at the end of the war, the head of the Norwegian intelligence office estimated or made a statement about the value of the work done by SIS and intelligence in general in Norway during the war. And he said that they contributed significantly to the sinking of Germany's two biggest battleships, the Tirpitz and the Bismarck, and also the Scharnhorst, and to significant damage being caused to the Prince Eugen, the Hipper, and the Scheer. So that's a substantial part of the German naval fleet. And the Tirpitz was the real threat. The Bismarck was sunk relatively early on in the war, in early in 1941. Thereafter, the Tirpitz moved up to Norway in the early part of 1941 and remained there throughout the war until it was sunk in November 1944. And that represented a huge threat to Allied shipping. And Churchill was really preoccupied with her and with the threat that she posed. He called it the beast. And he kept asking what progress was being made to sink it. And in the end, something like 24 operations were carried out against it, one by SOE, which very nearly succeeded, actually. They carried underwater, they carried a couple of chariots up, towed behind a fishing vessel, which got through all the controls into the fjord in Norway, where the Tirpitz was moored. But unfortunately, the weather changed. It's a big open fjord. Some waves got up and it sheared the tow cable. When they were through everything, they would have been able to carry out the attack. And that was a tragedy. So that was another And that was a combination, actually, of work by SIS and SOE together, because SOE couldn't have done that with some of the without some of the intelligence provided by SIS. Generally, the two services didn't get on well in Norway, but that was an example where they did.
And what work did the resistance play in Norway in cracking the Enigma code?
Not really directly at all. But one thing that did make a difference was some of the earlier combined operations raids, which did use Norwegians working for SOE. They were raids on the Lofoten Islands and on Måløy, and there were some other smaller ones as well. They were aimed at destroying fisheries plants of one kind or another and just generally making a nuisance of themselves. But a subsidiary reason for that, those raids, was actually to provide cover for acquiring German code material from mainly from weather trawlers without the Germans being aware of it. And they achieved that in a couple of cases. And actually, they had sent someone from Bletchley Park responsible for code breaking on the raids to make sure that they acquired the right bits and pieces. Some of those actually enabled them to read, as a result, the codes for the German surface fleet in home waters throughout the war, and also for U-boats up in that area of the Arctic, and also contributed, I think, to the the breaking of Abwehr military codes, and now military intelligence codes, that is, Abwehr military intelligence codes. That was quite important because the Abwehr were sending a lot of Norwegian agents over to Britain. There were more than 20 cases when they tried to do that. One actually successful, and three very nearly successful. And for the security service, thanks to Bletchley Park, being able to get advance notice of those operations meant that most of them were, most of the agents were arrested pretty soon after they arrived here.
Wow, certainly. Well, it sounds like they were certainly extremely prolific over the course of the war. I think maybe we've touched on some of their successes already, but I wanted to know if you had any particular opinion about what their biggest successes might have been.
Well, actually, the combined effect of some of the early raids and some of the operations which SOE carried out was to make Hitler concerned that Norway would be the target chosen by the Allies for an invasion of occupied Europe. And as a result of that, he kept sending more German soldiers to Norway. And at the high point, there were about 400,000 German soldiers in Norway, which is just about the same number as able-bodied Norwegians. So that's a very significant number. And what that meant was that actually all of those soldiers weren't somewhere else. They weren't in France. They weren't elsewhere. So it slightly took them out of the equation. And that was pretty valuable. As a result, later in the war, when the Germans tried to move those soldiers back, the resistance mounted a series of attacks on the railways and the bridges and the means of communications. So they slowed the rate of German troop withdrawal from late 1944 from four divisions a month to about one. So, I mean, that was a substantial difference, and that was a big success, as were operations against German U-boats, against their fuel, against their torpedo dumps. So by after one of those operations, I think there were only five working torpedoes left in the south of Norway, which obviously was a great benefit to Allied shipping. I think most people, though, will be more aware of the heavy water raids against the plant at Rjukan in Telemark, which substantially damaged the German capacity to produce and transport heavy water back to Germany. And although we now know that that was heavy water was not a success, going to be a successful way for the Germans to develop an atomic bomb, that wasn't known at the time. And the fact that we spent so much effort, visible effort, to the Germans trying to destroy it must have helped to convince the Germans that their research was on the right track.
And that story, I think, yeah, definitely is one I've heard about before, and reading these, you know, the tales of these like almost superhuman endurance that these men went through to blow up the heavy water plant is absolutely awe-inspiring.
It is. It really is one of the highlights, resistance highlights of the war, I think, yes.
In the interest of fairness, I don't think asking what their biggest failures are is quite accurate. The biggest, I suppose, missed opportunities that they had over the course of the war, like things that could have gone better, you know, aborted missions, that kind of thing.
Well, I think, there was one, there were two particular low points. We don't need to call them failures. The first was Operation Freshman, when two gliders carrying commandos crashed and all of the commandos and the crew of one of the aircraft that was towing them were killed. They were either killed in the crashes or they were tortured and murdered by the Germans. And that was probably the largest setback which resistance had. But of course, it was very soon followed by the success of the much smaller resistance operation led by Joachim Runeberg, known as Operation Gunnerside, and that was an outstanding success. There was also a bad example of the consequences of failure to communicate properly between SIS and SOE, when a boat carrying, first of all, SIS agents dropped some agents at a little place called Televorg on the west coast of Norway, followed soon by an SOE boat, which dropped some SOE agents. And that much activity and the behavior of the SOE agents after they'd landed attracted German attention. The Germans mounted a raiding party. The SOE agents resisted. They killed the two Gestapo officers. They took all the men away and sent them to about 70 in all. Half of them, nearly half of them, never came back. And all the women were sent to camps in Norway. There were other smaller examples, but that's the worst one, and that's probably the worst disaster for the resistance. And had that second boat gone somewhere else, well, possibly it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, they certainly do sound horrible.
Well, I think, but that one and the other smaller things were really the consequences of a lack of trust and cooperation.
Mm. Yeah, and I know that's something that they definitely did remedy over the course of the war, and by the end, you do say.
Well, on the Anglo-Norwegian side, I was actually there, meaning on the British side, because I think the relationship between SIS and SOE was not as good as it could have been, and there are a number of examples of that. It was just one organisation not really being willing to trust the other, because to do so would mean that they'd get in each other's way. They weren't just being perverse and sort of this is my thing, you can't have it. They were doing it for sort of reasons which were valid to them, but which took no account of what the other organisation wanted to do.
That is interesting, because I do think it's something that I certainly hadn't heard about before, this rivalry, and it's quite sobering to realise that that it did actually endanger and actually cause the death of so many people. Shifting our focus slightly, I wanted to know a little bit more about these records that you know, find yourself working through in order to write the book. Just because, like you said, it's so many of them have just never been looked at before. So I kind of wanted to know what the experience of that was like for you. Like, were there any surprises that you found during your research, or like favourite discoveries that you had?
Yeah, I mean, you never know. When you go into an archive, you know, you open a file, the file description's not terribly revealing. You don't know whether you're going to be spending the next half hour wasting your time or finding some priceless jewel that is actually going to make your day or your week or your month. And anyone who's done any archival research will resonate with, because it's a common feeling. And actually, I think to see sometimes set out a complete detailed story of an operation in one form or another, that's pretty exciting. The problem is that often, and I'll mention a couple of those as highlights in a moment, but the problem is very often, because these files were being put together during the war when everyone was working mad hours and frenetically busy, they didn't necessarily have time to look after all their sort of paper and store it in a sensible, systematic way. Life was just much too short. So you tend to find a little bit here and a little bit there, and need to need to do all the work to sort of put it together. So that can be a bit of a chore sifting through all that. But when you get a nugget, then that really is exciting. And I think in the National Archives, there were two particular nuggets I found, which were buried away in the Admiralty files. I found the citations for the Distinguished Service Order, DSOs, medals, which SIS wanted to give to two of its Norwegian agents who had been working effectively for the Admiralty because they'd been collecting naval intelligence. And they were for Bjørn Roholt and Torstein Raabye. And they were actually contemporary accounts written by SIS of exactly what these people had done, and they represented as detailed a story as you can get. And SIS had sent them to the Admiralty and asked them to comment, because they were, after all, naval intelligence matters that they were reporting on. So they wanted Admiralty support for what they were doing. So those were pretty exciting. Lots of papers in the Norwegian archives, which the progress reports for SIS for all their stations, so you could follow in detail how the stations were getting on. And there were about 100 SIS stations at one time or another in Norway. So that's quite a lot of material there. And that was all interesting. But perhaps the biggest surprise was actually something that I was able to obtain from the files of the Russian intelligence service in Moscow, the NKVD, the predecessor to the current intelligence service, which were reports that had been sent by Kim Philby, a member of the British Secret Service, who was working in counter-intelligence at that stage. And he had sent some reports in August 1941 back to Moscow, which described reporting from a German Abwehr military intelligence agent, which SIS was in contact with. And there's no reference to that anywhere in any of the files that have been released. So actually to find out from a Russian source that the British service was running a German agent who was spying on both Norwegians and Russians, because this was around the time of the German invasion of Russia in Barbarossa in the middle of 1941. So to find that out, and then actually to find a little snippet in British files which sort of backed it up, that was the most unexpected success I've had anywhere, and that was really very exciting.
Yeah, I can imagine. I do think it's incredible that these, you know, reports that people put together getting on for maybe like 80 90 years ago,
can still have the potential to surprise us in those kind of ways. You know, history has a very strange habit of suddenly throwing us curveballs, even though it happened so long ago.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Well, that was the biggest one. I've had a few good ones, but that was the most outstanding one.
So to kind of round things off a little bit, I was wondering what the legacy of this alliance was today. Is it, do you feel like it's become better acknowledged over the past, I suppose, decades, but also in the years since you published your book? Do you think there's more awareness of it now in the UK, or do we still have a long way to go?
I think since the war, immediately after the war, Norway tried for a couple of years to go back to a policy of neutrality, which didn't really succeed because Russian influence was growing, and so the Norwegians decided they wanted to throw in their lot, if you like, with the West, and became a founder member of NATO. So that enabled relations to get back to a very close level, which they probably remained more or less ever since. I know from my own experience of working in Oslo that there's a great deal of cooperation and sharing. Our Marines, for example, still go up to the north of Norway every winter and do Arctic training up there. There's a lot of very close trust and collaboration. But I think it's always useful, always helpful, to be able to add something to the mix and to point to something which demonstrates just quite how valuable the relationship which we had with them, with the Norwegians during the war, after that sticky start, and how much we still continue to depend on each other. I wouldn't presume to think that my book has made any difference, but I hope that it will have made interesting reading for people on both sides of the North Sea.
Well, it certainly did me. So yes, long may it continue. So my final question then, what is one thing you hope people will take away from reading Secret Alliances?
Will you allow me two?
Absolutely.
The first, I think, is respect for the bravery and stubbornness in the face of real difficulties, particularly in the early part of the war when it really didn't look good for Norway's prospects, but the bravery of those people who took part in the resistance, many of whom lost their lives. I think that deserves to be remembered, and it's really one of the reasons why I wrote the book. The other is actually the importance of trust and cooperation, particularly between different countries, between different organisations. We almost always get better outcomes when we can find ways of working together. From our own personal relationships, if you like, right up to major intergovernmental projects. And after the sticky start we had, once we really learnt what we could achieve together, there were some substantial things. And I think that is a lesson which it's a good idea for us to continue to be reminded about.
Yes, it is very easy to take today's world for granted, but it's also important to remember that there are people who fought very hard for that to happen, which I think your book is a very nice addition to the kind of, I suppose, pantheon of work celebrating that, and especially in Norway, which I don't think there's enough about, quite frankly. So Tony, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me.
Real pleasure. Thank you very much, Vicky.
Thanks for listening to another Bite Back podcast. If hearing Tony's insights has made you want to find out more about Norway and its wartime history, then why not check out his book Secret Alliances? It's out now in paperback and available from bitebackpublishing.com and all good bookshops. And don't forget to like and subscribe. Until next time.